This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also now available as a podcast. Just go to your podcast app on your iPhone or iPad or Android and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways than ever to stay in touch with the union. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, please keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. Any comments on this show or other shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. Tonight, we're talking about changes to the New York State workers' compensation system. Joining us by phone to talk about this issue is a longtime DC 37 partner on worker compensation issues, attorney Robert Gray. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the show. Let's step back. Let's talk about workers' compensation and the history of workers' compensation and what it's supposed to do.
The workers' comp system was originally a bargain between workers and employers where workers gave up their right to sue the employer and the employer promised to deliver wage replacement benefits and medical treatment to the worker quickly and with a minimum of litigation.
And how's the system funded?
The system is funded by employers buying workers' compensation insurance or choosing to self-insure like the City of New York. And then employers are charged assessments which go to fund the operations of the State Workers' Compensation Board, which is the agency that decides these cases.
Now, there are proposed changes. I know that we have talked about this. We've covered this in our Public Employee Press, and we've been talking about this for months now. Proposed changes to the current system, what do they do? What do these proposals call for specifically?
Well, one of the things that workers got in the original workers' compensation compromise is not only did they get wage replacement benefits, they also got some awards for permanent injury to limbs to make up for the fact that you can't sue the employer. So someone who breaks their arm or tears ligaments in their knee or has a total joint replacement or an injury along those lines is entitled to some compensation for the injury if there's permanency. And anything they're paid for lost wages while they're out get deducted from that award. Now, we call those awards schedule loss awards because there are schedules in the workers' compensation law that lay out how much you get for each body part. Back in March, the legislature directed the Workers' Compensation Board to update the guidelines that it uses to evaluate these injuries to take into account advances in medicine. Unfortunately, what happened is that in September, instead of just updating the existing guidelines, the Workers' Compensation Board issued a set of proposals that completely rewrote the guidelines and, for practical purposes, would have eliminated these schedule loss awards and left workers with permanent injury to their arms and legs and hands and feet with no compensation for the injury at all, which is not what was intended in the original workers' compensation bargain, and it wasn't what the legislature intended back in March.
So how did this happen? Any ideas of how this happened?
Well, the business council and the insurance industry every year attack benefits for injured workers, and over the years they've capped permanent partial disability, and they've gotten control over medical treatment through medical treatment guidelines, and they've required workers to use their diagnostic test centers for radiology, for MRIs and X-rays and CAT scans, and they've gotten control over prescription medication. And they're always looking to cut costs. In the budget in March, they got caps on temporary partial disability, and this is one of the last big ticket items that they can shoot at to take benefits away from workers. So this whole thing was really driven by a campaign from the Business Council.
So they're putting limits on how much workers can be compensated. They're also altering the process by which decisions are made about compensation. This idea that you, this idea of who's making the calls sounds different to me. Yes?
Well, the Workers' Compensation Board is ultimately the agency that gets to make the call, but it does seem that the Business Council has an increasing influence on the things that the board decides to do, which is unfortunate for injured workers.
Well, yeah, and if you are using, you know, Dr. A versus Dr. B, and Dr. A is the employer's doctor, I would imagine that that's going to affect the decision, or could affect the decision, or the recommendation, or the or anything about the care of the worker.
Well, the real issue here, for the most part, was not who gets to use what doctor, although one of the things they put in the regulations would have limited the worker's ability to go use a consultant to get an opinion. The real issue here is that what the proposal was would have changed the guidelines or the rule book that the doctors on both sides were playing by. So if we have a guideline that says if you tear your rotator cuff, that's a 10% loss of use of the arm, and then we add depending on what your functional loss is, and you change the book to say that the rotator cuff tear itself is worth zero, then it doesn't matter whether your doctor looks at it or the insurance company's doctor looks at it, the result is still less. So what this was a fight about was whether the guidelines should be changed.
And now, what stage are we at now? Because we have been trying to tell members, we've got a petition on our website, dc37.net. There's been a number of articles that we've written about this. What is the status of the process?
Well, we do have some good news. After the Workers' Comp Board published its proposed revisions to the guidelines in early September, there was a huge public outcry. DC 37 played a very key role in that, thanks largely to the efforts of Henry Garrido, the executive director, and Gia Mejia, the occupational safety and health department director, and many other unions and individuals also pitched in. As a result of that outcry, on the day before Thanksgiving, the Workers' Comp Board pulled back its proposal and issued a new proposal. And the new proposal largely keeps the existing guidelines, although it does cut benefits for a few specific types of injury. So we've had a very successful campaign pushing back against what really would have been an anti-worker change, and DC 37 played a huge part in that.
DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido, you just mentioned him, wrote a letter to the Workers' Compensation Board Chair Clarissa Rodriguez in which he stated that, quote, the board's proposals would strip out members of important protections and due process rights and would create a system ripe for abuse by employers, insurers, independent medical examiners, and IME vendors. They impose new burdens on DC 37 members who are injured on the job and may also limit their earning capacity. I suspect we are all in agreement on that here.
Henry Garrido wrote a terrific letter, and it's clear that the Workers' Compensation Board heard what he had to say and took it into account. And as I said, that played a key role in making the outcome here far better than it looked like it was going to be going in.
We're talking to attorney Robert Gray. You're an expert on workers' comp issues.
It's what I've been doing for 30 years.
And what's your sense of how workers, the state of workers from 30 years ago to the state of workers today?
Honestly, I think that for the most part, over the last 25 years, we have seen a pretty continuous attack on worker rights and worker benefits. And in workers' compensation, although the maximum rates have increased, which is good for high-wage workers, overall, I think the system has become much more difficult for workers to navigate and get benefits out of. And I think when they get benefits, they often get less than what they used to get. So unfortunately, I think the system has been slowly going backwards for over two decades now. And I'm hoping that we can turn that around with the assistance of labor.
And finally, when is the Workers' Comp Board supposed to make the decision?
The Workers' Comp Board is required to make the decision by the end of the year. It has a meeting scheduled for December 29th, and if it has not made its decision by December 29th, then the board members will have to vote on it. Right now, we're in a public comment period on the new proposal, and that public comment period ends on December 22nd. If people want to comment on the current proposal, I think there are utilities available for them on the DC 37 website, and they could also go to the Workers' Compensation Alliance website, which is nyworkerscompensationalliance.org.
Attorney Robert Gray, thank you very much for being on the show this evening, and we'll be in touch again to find out how this all played out.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Last week, we had the public advocate of the city of New York, Letitia James, and when we were talking about the her annual worst landlords list. And I saw just shortly after that conversation that the City Council of New York has passed a legislation that is certification of no harassment, which requires specific building owners seeking to demolish or make significant alterations to their building to prove that they have not engaged in harassment before they can get permits from the city Department of Buildings. With us now is Emily Goldstein. She is senior campaign organizer at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Welcome to State of the Union.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the legislation, and let's back up and talk about the problem that this legislation is addressing and the good work that your organization is doing.
Just, sure.
Okay.
So thank you so much for having me on to discuss this. I would say big picture, the problem is that rents are rising in New York City. Incomes are not rising along with them. And more residents are being pushed out of their homes, particularly renters in rent-stabilized housing, because that tends to be more affordable to lower-income people and tends to be places where people have in the past been able to stay in their homes for a long period of time because of the protections that are in place. As more and more neighborhoods are gentrifying, as market rate rents are going up in more and more neighborhoods, what we've been seeing is that the pressure that a lot of landlords are placing on these lower-income tenants have been going up as well, because they're seeing the gap between what rent-stabilized tenants are paying, which are relatively affordable rents, and what they could theoretically be getting on the market in their neighborhood. And they have this really terrible incentive to drive out lower-paying tenants and hike up those rents. And so we really developed the idea around this legislation in response to that problem.
Now, what does that harassment look like? I know folks are sometimes offered money. Sometimes it's pitifully low to change, to move out of your house. But what else are landlords doing that constitute harassment?
Yeah, and it looks so many different ways in so many different places, and every time we think we have a handle on it, they come up with new and horrifying tactics. But some of the sort of common things we see are, one is, as you said, these sort of pressure on tenants to basically take a payoff or a buyout in order to move out. But realistically, those buyouts are generally not going to be enough for people to be able to find similar housing and stay in it long term anywhere else. We also sometimes see just like a refusal to properly maintain the building or to make repairs. There are some cases where new market rate tenants will be able to get repairs, but the long-term rent-stabilized tenants can't get anything done in their apartments. There are times when building-wide services are neglected, and those are all ways that tenants get pushed out of their homes. There are also tactics like just constantly taking tenants to housing court on a frivolous basis or sending threatening notices. Especially more recently, we've been hearing about incidents like threatening to call ICE or threatening to call child services, right, and sort of threatening to do things that are really harmful to people's lives that can all be used to drive people out of their homes.
And how does this legislation work? I don't think I've done it justice in terms of describing it, or been as clear as I could be about describing it. But basically, it's saying if you want to do something to your building, you got to prove that you haven't been messing with the folks who live in that building.
Yeah, I mean, that's it in essence. There's a lot of technical detail to it, but that is what it is at the bottom line. And what's important about this legislation, and the reason we worked so hard for it, the whole point of the legislation is to try to set up a disincentive. So when I was describing the problem, you know, if you're an unscrupulous landlord, if you're not super concerned with ethics or morals or even following the law, because harassing tenants is already illegal, people just do it anyway, you know, what they're following is a profit motive, right? And they're doing what this thing that they think makes sense, they're harassing out tenants, because they see that as a route to increasing their profits. So the concept behind this law is to say we're going to set up a system where the logical business decision and the logical sort of understanding of how you can or can't make profits in the future on your building is going to be that if you harass out your tenants, you're going to be able to make less money. You're not going to be able to sell your building for as much if you're trying to sell it off. You're going to have trouble getting the permits you need in order to raise the rents. You're going to, right, like that it's going to hurt your future profits instead of help them. With the idea that for all of the different tools we've tried and for all of the punishments and for all of the things you can do to try to sort of address things after the fact, in reality, too many landlords are just doing what they think is going to make them the most money. And so we're trying to set up a situation where harassing tenants is not actually going to make you money. It's going to take money out of your pocket. And hopefully that way fewer landlords will do it.
And we should, I mentioned that the city council has passed this legislation. We should give a shout out to council member Brad Lander, who was the bill's sponsor, correct?
Yes. Council member Lander was the lead sponsor and has been just a champion for years with us on this legislation.
And given the way the city is, I am always stunned at how the city has changed over the past decade in terms of you know, places like Long Island City, the development of Williamsburg, you know, any number of places in Brooklyn and Queens, How do you keep up with trying to talk a little bit about the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development? How do you keep up with that change? And how well is the city doing in ensuring that the neighborhoods that are on the rise are not driving out folks as gentrification too often does?
Sure. So the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, where I work, is a membership organization. Our members are neighborhood-based community organizations that do work around affordable housing and equitable economic development. And so our members are in neighborhoods in every borough of the city doing local organizing work with tenants, with small business owners, with people who are trying to develop a local jobs pipeline. They also, some of our members are actually building and managing affordable housing that is run by the nonprofit sector, and so it's sort of taken off of the market system. Some of our members do direct services as well. And so ANHD's philosophy as an organization is that local communities and local organizations and people who are closest to the ground are the ones that are best equipped to identify local problems and needs, develop local solutions, and then, you know, be the power that helps move those solutions forward. At the same time, a lot of the forces driving problems and the potential forces driving solutions aren't only happening at the neighborhood level. And so where we come in is to work across our members and with our member organizations and develop coalitions to move city legislation, move state legislation, and sort of try to address the issues that people are seeing across neighborhoods at a broader policy or legislative level. And that's how the effort to win the Certificate of No Harassment Law came into being. We coordinated the coalition, but it was a group called the Coalition Against Tenant Harassment that included neighborhood organizing from all over the city that really was the driving force.
Now, there are certain pockets of the city where this harassment is particularly offensive or you know, happening on more frequently than others?
Yeah. You know, it takes different shapes. It looks a little different in different places. I would say that the types of harassment that I'm describing really tend to focus on rent-stabilized housing, and so there are some neighborhoods of the city that have much higher concentrations of rent-stabilized housing than others. There are, unfortunately, some neighborhoods in the city where a lot of the rent-stabilized housing has already been lost, and so these same things for the pockets that remain, but at a neighborhood level, it may be less widespread than the communities that still actually have most of the affordable housing and are trying to hang on to it.
Let me interrupt just for a second. Mm-hmm. What is, when we talk about rent stabilization in 2017, and you mentioned a point that just triggered, are there still pockets of the city where rent stabilization really does help people live? And how has that changed, though, over the years? Because with these market rate rents and everything else that's happened throughout the landscape, I'm just wondering what the state of play is in terms of rent stabilization.
Yeah, so there's somewhere between 800,000 and 900,000, I don't have the number in front of me, rent-stabilized apartments left in New York City. So that's a lot. I mean, that's a bit under a million. That's a lot of apartments. That's a lot of families. As I said, it's more concentrated in some neighborhoods than others. There are some neighborhoods that are mostly small homes, right, or sort of like never had a large concentration. There are some neighborhoods, particularly in a lot of parts of Manhattan, that have had a significant amount of their rent-stabilized housing lost already. But I would point out, thinking about those neighborhoods, that in many cases, the rent-stabilized housing that does remain is some of the only affordable housing left in that neighborhood because everything else is so rich and so expensive. And so it's one of the few ways that there is any economic integration in those areas.
Right.
But then there are other neighborhoods, a lot of parts of the Bronx, a lot of parts of South and Central Brooklyn that still have really, and a lot of parts of Upper Manhattan that still have really high concentrations of rent-stabilized housing, where really sort of, in some ways, the core of the residential community is a rent-stabilized community, and people are trying to hang on to that.
We're talking with Emily Goldstein. She is senior campaign organizer at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. I've got a question. How did you come to this work?
Well, I'm a born and raised New Yorker, and I grew up in a rent-stabilized apartment. So this has always been sort of a part of my understanding of how New York worked and what was important. The New York I grew up in was diverse and, you know, focused on working class and middle class folks and people of all sort of races and backgrounds really able to live and work in communities together. And to me, you know, that's the city I believe in and that's the city I love. So on a personal level, you know, I believe that what makes New York great is that it's a place where people of all races or immigrant communities where low-income and moderate-income people can live and thrive, and I don't want to see us lose that city.
And you also grew up in a city where stores had stores, as opposed to, I'm stunned by the number of empty storefronts in Manhattan and outside of Manhattan. One of the great things about the Upper West Side, which is where I spent a great deal of time when I was younger, was the amount of, you know, ethnic flavor and personality of the different stores. And there are so many storefronts now that are just empty on Broadway, for example. And that must come into play when we're talking about neighborhood development.
Yeah, I mean, neighborhoods are not just housing. They're everything together. And communities are people and the environment. And as you said, that's about who can afford to live. That's about who can afford to work. That's about who can afford to shop and what are the services and goods and basic amenities like laundromats,
I don't even
want to call it an amenity, it's just a basic need, that are available that make any given neighborhood a viable community. And you're right, that is the... I grew up on the Upper West Side, so when you say the Upper West Side, that's exactly right. You know, the storefronts used to be small and local and more community-oriented and affordable and accessible to the wide mix of people that lived in the neighborhood. And I think we're seeing that vanish from a lot of places.
Emily Goldstein, senior campaign organizer at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. We've been talking about the recently passed City Council certification of no harassment legislation that requires specific building owners seeking to demolish or make significant alterations to their buildings to prove that they have not engaged in harassment before they can get permits from the New York City Department of Buildings. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's just about all the time we have on the show for this week. Before we go, a few announcements. You can find out about the latest issues impacting our union by attending an organizing department meeting at your job site. For dates and locations, please call 212-815-1095. And you can share the holiday spirit with less fortunate members of our union family and participate in DC-37's annual holiday drive sponsored by the Personal Service Unit and the Municipal Employee Legal Services of DC-37. For more information, just check the Public Employee Press and our website, www.dc37.net. I want to thank our guests, attorney Robert Gray and Emily Goldstein, senior campaign organizer at the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development, for joining us this evening. Remember, any comments you have about this show or any of our other shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. Andrea Monocchio is the engineer. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.